The seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable, and it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohamed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture, and my little finger was broken. I was repeatedly subjected to hitting on the head, causing bleeding multiple times. There was almost daily torture in the Israeli prisons.
The Israeli Prison Service told the Washington Post that it was not aware of the torture claims. It said prisoners have the right to file complaints that will be fully examined. Israeli troops raided Al-Shifa Hospital last year, alleging Hamas militants were using the site as a command center. Hospital officials denied the allegations. Abu Salmeya was released alongside some 50 Palestinians who were returned to Gaza for medical treatment. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
The U.S. Supreme Court ended its term Monday by ruling for the first time that former presidents have broad immunity from criminal prosecution. A decision that almost certainly means Donald Trump won't stand trial before the November election. Later in the evening, following the court's decision, President Joe Biden delivered brief remarks to the nation.
I know I will respect the limits of the presidential powers I have for 3.5 years. But any president, including Donald Trump, will now be free to ignore the law.
My colleague Scott Walterman spoke with Carolyn Shapiro, founder and co-director of Chicago Kent Institute on the Supreme Court, for analysis on the historic ruling.
I think this is a remarkably sweeping opinion that upends assumptions that we have had for almost 250 years about nobody being above the law. I find it shocking, and frankly, I find it terrifying.
How much of a rewrite of what we believed in yesterday is this?
There's never been a court holding that says that the president does not have immunity. So it's not that the court has overruled something that was already there. And there haven't been criminal prosecutions of former presidents in the past either. So in that sense, this is an unprecedented situation on both sides. On the other hand, there is a principle that nobody is above the law. And it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways that I think go far beyond anything that anybody could have assumed or anticipated. For example, the court says that the motive for what the president does is not relevant in determining whether or not there's an official act. So if the president conspires with Justice Department officials to throw an election, because just talking to Justice Department officials is part of an official act, is generally an official act, the fact that he's doing it for corrupt and criminal reasons is not relevant, and it's still, and he still will have immunity. In addition, the court says that the prosecution can't even rely on those official acts as evidence to support the charges they are allowed to bring. So the prosecution is deprived of significant amounts of evidence that would provide the jury with the context to be able to evaluate mens rea, or the motive by under which the president acted. So those two parts of the holding are really quite extraordinary and go much further than I thought was even possible. I could have imagined some immunity, but this opinion is astonishing.
In the dissent opinion, Justice Sotomayor wrote that this is the opposite of everything the conservative justices have said to date about how they interpret the Constitution. Can you tell us about that?
The conservative justices, most of them, claim to be originalists, which is to say that they look to what they would call the original public meaning of the Constitution at the time it was written and ratified, or the specific amendments at the time they were written and ratified. And they rely on that what they can deduce from that history and also from tradition. So they look to what has been part of our system for a long time to determine the meaning of the Constitution. Now, they make claims about how this leads to a certain amount of constraint on judges and justices. They make claims about this being the most sensible way to engage in constitutional interpretation. Those are highly contestable claims. But in this case, they didn't even try to do that. Justice Sotomayor lays out the history that shows that the framers would have been aghast at something like this. They did not want to have a king. We just fought a revolution to get away from a king. And the majority has really nothing to say about it. They just kind of say, well, yeah, there's some evidence there, but it's kind of a wash. And then they move on. They engage in no meaningful historical analysis at all. So that's, I think, a big part of her accusation.
She also talked about the fact that the Constitution doesn't mention immunity for the president, right?
That's correct. They're reading into the Constitution dramatic and, as I've said, extremely broad immunity that can be found nowhere in the text. They are reading it in because they conclude that the president has to be vigorous and be able to do the job without being afraid of being prosecuted later. That seems to put all the weight on one side of the scale. And it is based on no text in the Constitution, and it is based on no history.
Carolyn Shapiro, founder of the Chicago Kent Institute on the Supreme Court, speaking with my colleague, Scott Walterman. Turning our attentions overseas, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has made his first visit to neighboring Ukraine since Russia's full-scale invasion. While meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Orban, who has warm ties with Russia, said the war is Europe's most important issue. We hear more from Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
During the visit, Orban offered Ukraine to agree on a ceasefire with Russia and then sit down at the negotiating table. According to the Prime Minister of Hungary, Volodymyr Zelensky expressed his frank opinion about this proposal. Neither Zelensky nor Orban specified what the response of the Ukrainian president was. Viktor Orban noted that peace is an important issue and that the war in Ukraine currently has a very intense effect on the security of Europe. Orban said that he highly appreciates all initiatives by Zelensky to achieve peace, but emphasized that these initiatives will take a lot of time. He asked Zelensky to think about whether it is possible to go another way, to take a break, cease fire, then continue negotiations. After all, in Orban's opinion, a ceasefire could ensure the acceleration of the pace of these negotiations. In addition to the war, Zelensky and Orban discussed Ukrainian-Hungarian relations. Both emphasized that this meeting was an important step for establishing relations between the countries and solving accumulated problems, and also said that they plan to sign an agreement on bilateral relations between Ukraine and Hungary in the future. The leaders agreed on the creation of a Ukrainian school in Hungary for refugees from Ukraine. Zelensky noted that there is an agreement that Ukraine and Hungary will continue to work together on the details. In early May, Volodymyr Zelensky held telephone talks with Viktor Orban, during which he underscored Ukraine's interest in good neighborly relations with Hungary. Orban, who has ruled Hungary with a parliamentary majority since 2010, has angered many EU leaders with his apparent attacks on democracy, the bloc's founding principles and inclusiveness, his opposition to sanctions against Russia, and his close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. The day before, on July 1st, Zelensky met with a bipartisan delegation of U.S. Congress members led by the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Mike Turner. Zelensky told the congressman about the situation on the front line and the priority needs of the Ukrainian army. They discussed the main directions of further American assistance, in particular additional air defense systems and missiles, as well as ways to further increase sanctions pressure on Russia. During a meeting with journalists, Turner noted that the United States will continue to support Ukraine regardless of who will be the next president of the United States. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And brewing in the Atlantic, Hurricane Beryl is barreling across the Caribbean Sea as a monstrous storm. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Hurricane Beryl is headed toward Jamaica and the Cayman Islands with life-threatening winds and storm surge.
Maximum winds are up to 165 miles per hour. It's a Category 5 hurricane.
Eric Blake is a senior specialist with the National Hurricane Center.
We expect the storm to begin to lose some strength later today, but we still expect it to be a powerful hurricane when it affects Jamaica on Wednesday.
The storm made a direct hit on Carriacou, ripping off rooftops and leaving streets covered with debris. It also left damage in Grenada and St. Vincent, where logistics manager Marlon Gibson was interviewed by Sky News.
All around me, there were houses in the village. Their roofs were flying past. You could see it passing. It was just a terrifying experience.
Beryl is the earliest Category 5 storm ever to form in the Atlantic.
There's never been a Category 4 hurricane in the Atlantic during June.
Brian McNulty at the University of Miami is a tropical weather researcher.
The water there is hotter than it would normally be at the peak of the season.
I'm Jennifer King.
Beryl is the earliest Category 5 storm ever to form in the Atlantic, fueled by record warm waters. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London in Washington. Recent crackdowns have scared many protesters off the streets in Syria's last rebel-held stronghold, but some rallies continue, with locals demanding economic relief and the release of political prisoners in what officials call Syria's forgotten city of Idlib. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul. Our journalists in Syria do not want to be named for security reasons.
Protests in the Idlib region of northwestern Syria have been going on since February, over what residents say are unlawful detentions and economic disparity. They continue despite a crackdown by the rebel leadership of northwestern Syria, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, which has deployed security forces ahead of expected demonstrations, set up checkpoints, and made arrests. Protesters are also calling for the resignation of some top leaders. At a recent demonstration in Idlib, Imad Ali Pasha says he protested the Syrian government in 2011, and all these years later, the government that they are now living under is arresting people, impoverishing them, and leaving them to suffer in camps without services. Northwestern Syria under HTS is the only major region still at war with the government of President Bashar al-Assad, and some protesters say the group's failure to recapture lands taken by the government is among their complaints. More pressing, however, is the extreme poverty that plagues the region, with more than half the population of roughly 5 million people internally displaced, mostly living in camps without humanitarian aid. In the markets, prices have skyrocketed. Sellers say people close to the government run corrupt monopolies that drive up prices. Ali El-Dairi sells vegetables in an Idlib street market. He says when demand is on the rise, sellers who have a monopoly on certain items, like tomatoes, meat, or cucumbers, can reduce the supply, raising prices. Lawyers say people are being arrested by the hundreds for political dissent. Khaldun Shamaya is a lawyer in Idlib. He says when people are arrested, there are no trials, no warrants, and no way to know why the person was arrested. But officials from the Syrian Salvation Government, the civilian leadership associated with HTS, say they do not arrest people for criticizing the government. Mohammed al-Bashir heads the Syrian Salvation Government. He says protesters' demands have shed light on government shortcomings related to the economy, cost of living, security, and legal issues. He calls Idlib a forgotten city, isolated from international aid in a region now home to more than four times the population it was built for, with internally displaced families from every corner of Syria. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
At least 100 people are dead and scores more injured after a stampede at a religious event in northern India. More from Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
Officials say more than 150 people have been admitted to hospitals after the crash in a village in Hathras district of Uttar Pradesh state, adding that the death toll is likely to rise. Local media reports the stampede occurred as attendees rushed to leave following an event with a religious leader named Bol Baba. Attendee Shukantala Devi tells the Press Trust of India people started falling one upon another. Those who were crushed died, and the crowd at the event was huge. Initial reports suggest that over 15,000 people had gathered for the event, which had permission to host just 5,000. Police said overcrowding may have been a factor. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And international experts are portraying a grim picture in war-torn Sudan. The warning following a report late last week by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, a global hunger monitor, finding the risk of famine in 14 areas across Sudan. The country ascended into chaos in April last year when tensions between the country's military and a notorious Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group exploded into open fighting in the capital and elsewhere in the country. I talked about it with Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Unfortunately, I think that many experts believe the IPC is actually understating the nature of the problem. There are parts of Sudan that clearly are in famine right now. And for example, there's a Klingendahl analysis that suggests 2.5 million Sudanese people could starve to death by the end of September. It is extraordinarily grave. And it is absolutely the case that both of the main belligerents here, the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, have been denying humanitarian access to people in grave need for months and months and months. And this has been, you know, historically a huge problem in Sudan. And right now it's a perfect storm of horrific violence, the largest displacement crisis in the world. Farmers have been unable to plant, and the situation really could not be more dire.
Most of the attention has turned away from Sudan, at least in the daily news cycle, to focused very heavily on Gaza, which is also obviously a very horrific situation for civilians. This situation has been going on even longer. Where do you see this going?
It's likely to continue until the entities that continue to support and supply weapons to these armed groups stop. There is not going to be a decisive military victory here. This has been clear for quite some time. And neither of these armed parties has any actual legitimacy in Sudan. They were not elected. The Constitution doesn't indicate that they have any legitimate authority here. And so, you know, this is a problem that's not just a Sudanese problem. It's a problem of international forces that continue to provide funds and weapons. And it's a problem for the region. This is a very alarming scenario for what is already an incredibly fragile region as well. So there are plenty of reasons the world should care. And there are pressure points that can be used to try to force the belligerents to think again about continuing to pursue this war. But there's the most urgent issue in front of us right now really is humanitarian access.
What does the international community need to do right now?
Well, there are still absolutely lives that can be saved. So what's critical is to kind of throw out the playbook that's not been working, stop pretending that either of these belligerents is a legitimate actor, and find as many innovative ways as possible to get cash and food into Sudan. And then there has to be real pressure and real consequences for the parties that continue to fuel and support this conflict. And that, you know, includes the United Arab Emirates, where there's a lot of evidence that they have continued to supply arms to the Rapid Support Forces, a group best known for its campaign of atrocities.
What others are supporting either side?
The Egyptians, the Saudis, the Iranians appear to be supporting the Sudanese armed forces. The Russians have played on both sides of this equation, having initially had a relationship with the RSF, and but being interested in the Red Sea access that the Sudanese armed forces are offering. So essentially what you have are a set of international actors pursuing very narrow and to some degree parochial agendas at the expense of the Sudanese people. And so that has to stop. There has to be consequence and reputational damage, if nothing else, that accrues to these actors that continue to enable this completely senseless conflict.
Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you so much. And that ends today's program, but there is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Lori London.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. issues in the news explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.